Chapter 9 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 9. This kind of life went on for 2 years, varied in the vacations with shooting and hunting and a certain amount of racing. My mother's country house was about 4 miles from Ascot, and we had a party for the races every year, which always included my uncle, Percy Wyndham, and my Aunt Madeline. It is interesting to recall that in those days, when Lord Coventry was master of the Buckhounds, the price for a ticket to the Royal Enclosure for the whole week, 4 days racing, was £1. Now it is 5 guineas. Quite half the people who get into the enclosure nowadays would have had no earthly at that period. My brother, Drumlanrig, being in the Coldstream Guards, supplied us all lavishly with tickets by the dozen for lunch and so forth in the guard's tent. Later, when I had horses of my own in France, for 2 short years only, alas, I had the opportunity of comparing French and English racing methods. I consider that the French system is far the better. There is a mania in England for special reserved enclosures, which is very snobbish, and also gives an opening to all sorts of undesirable, and what the English, with beautiful unawareness of their own characteristic failings, are wont to describe as un-English differentiations. In the year 1910, I was refused admission by the late Duke of Richmond to the private stand at Goodwood, though I had no difficulty in getting into the Jockey Club stand at Doncaster, the county stand at York, and similar enclosures all over the country. Of course, as long as the Duke of Richmond has a private stand, he is at liberty to refuse admission to persons of better birth than himself, while admitting any kind of nouveau riche or dubious profiteer. But the point is that racing is a national institution, and depends for support on those who pay for it, the public. And no private individual ought to be in a position to exercise the power of ostracism at his own private whim. At the time when the Duke refused to let me into the private stand at Goodwood, I was a member of White's Club. I had to leave it automatically when I was driven into the bankruptcy court by Ross and Lewis and Lewis in 1913. And to keep me out of a place to which I had a perfectly clear, natural right of entry, can only be described as ill-natured, to put it as mildly as possible. The fact that the Duke of Richmond happened to be a friend and partisan of my father-in-law, Colonel Custance, they had been in the Grenadiers together, with whom at the time I had a feud about my only son, Raymond, did not make his attitude any more chivalrous. At the beautiful racecourses round Paris, where one can go racing, 15 minutes in a taxi, day after day, all the year round, except during the time when the venue is changed to the south of France, and during the Deauville fortnight, there are only 2 enclosures. When I was racing, the Passage, grandstand and paddock, consisting of spacious lawns, gay with flowers and capable of holding a huge crowd without discomfort, was priced at 20 francs, which was then equivalent to 16 shillings, while the Pelouse was 3 francs, about half a crown. Anyone who chose to pay could go into the one or the other, according to his or her own fancy. The price for ladies was half that for men. The racing in France was, and is, just as good as it was and is in England, and, from the point of view of breeding stayers, the French are rapidly getting the better of the English, have, in fact, definitely established their superiority. I never go near a race course in England now, chiefly because I consider the prices of admission to be exorbitant, and the crowd and discomfort of the incessant railway journeys which are necessary, if one wants to race regularly, make the game hardly worth the candle, except either for the very rich, or those who go racing professionally or semi-professionally. During my school holidays and vacations, between the years 1886 up to the outbreak of the Oscar Wilde scandal in 1895, I frequently met and consorted with the late King Edward, then Prince of Wales, the Duke of Cambridge, and other royalties. I spent 2 seasons at Homburg while I was an undergraduate with my mother and my grandfather, Alfred Montgomery, who was on very intimate terms with the Prince, and we dined with the Prince, à la belle franquette, in the then prevailing fashion at Homburg, at least 6 times. My grandfather also introduced me to the Duke of Cambridge at Homburg, and afterwards used to take me to his house in Piccadilly. I have recollections of a dinner given to the Duke by my grandfather at the Travellers' Club, when the Duke, who was a very amiable old gentleman, and most kind to me, fell asleep after dinner, and snored, just at the moment when urgent reasons for leaving the table had manifested themselves in me. After a whispered and agonised appeal to my grandfather, I was given leave to slip out quietly, but, as luck would have it, I knocked over a knife or a fork, and the noise restored His Royal Highness to consciousness, to the great relief of his equerry and the rest of the party, which numbered about 8 guests. It was just about this time that I had what I can only, patche Mr. Frank Harris, describe as the great misfortune to meet Oscar Wilde. I was taken to his house, 16 Tite Street, by Lionel Johnson, the Wickhamist poet, who was one of my greatest friends at Oxford. He was 2 years at Winchester with me, but, as he was a scholar in college and I was in a house, and was moreover 3 years younger than he, I never had any acquaintance with him at school. He himself used to tell with great gusto the story that, when, in my 2nd year at Winchester, I was told by one of the masters, or dons as we called them at Winchester, Mr. Toy, to order my name, that is to say, report to the prefect of hall, who in turn reported to the headmaster, who sometimes thereupon administered a licking with a birch rod, it was he, Lionel Johnson, who, as prefect of hall at the time, officiated by holding up my shirt on the only occasion when I was licked. My executioner was Dr. Fearon, the bear, for whom, by the way, I retain a feeling of great affection, and who, for 7 years at Winchester, persisted in regarding me, in the face of all evidence to the contrary, as a sort of budding saint or angel child, and who let me off, in consequence, at least 6 other lickings, which I fully merited to receive. Lionel told this story, as I have said, but I can only say that I have no recollection at all of seeing him on that painful occasion, as I did not get to know him to speak to till 2 or more years later. He contributed a very charming, half-whimsical, half-pathetic poem to the last number of the Pentagram, and a magnificent one, as well as 7 contributions in prose, to my Oxford paper, The Spirit Lamp, of which more anon. Lionel was a delightful fellow, though exceedingly eccentric, and, alas, in his later years, greatly addicted to potations, which his small and childlike frame could not withstand. He was not much over 30 when he died. He had a mania for not going to bed, and if he could get anyone to sit up with him, he would discourse in the most brilliant way up till 5 o'clock in the morning. At other times of the day, he was rather noticeably silent. He was a great scholar, and undoubtedly a great poet, but the austerity and profundity of his best work makes him one who is never likely to appeal to any but a very eclectic audience. It was one of the griefs of his later years that he had introduced me to Wilde, though, of course, his doing so could not possibly have had any bearing on the events that followed. And Mr. Frank Harris may be interested to hear that his terrible and celebrated sonnet, beginning, "I hate you with a necessary hate," was, as Lionel told me himself long after it was written, meant for Wilde, and that the friend to whom it referred was myself, which indicates that he did not share Lord Darling's view as to the apportioning of the responsibility for the ruin which overtook us both, more or less. This sonnet was written quite a year before the final catastrophe, and Lionel Johnson's natural kindness of heart constrained him, in his sorrow for Wilde's terrible punishment, to deny the reference to Wilde of his sonnet to many people, though he admitted to me that he had meant it for Wilde at a time when he considered that he was ruining me, his junior, by 18 years. I deeply regret that Lionel did not live to have the satisfaction of seeing me in his beloved Catholic Church, which he joined almost immediately after he went down from Oxford. But as I knew he always prayed hard for my conversion, he no doubt had something to do with it, though I was almost anti-Catholic in the days of our association. After all, there is no reason to regret that he did not live to see his prayers answered, for of course he knows all about it now. End of chapter 9.